From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Monday, August 9th through Friday, August 13th, 2021. It was a week of trying to wrap our brains around millions, billions, and trillions of dollars discussed in issues ranging from lawsuits to relief packages to cybercrime. Buddy, can you spare a dime? A turnover in Albany, turmoil in Afghanistan, wildfires in the West, crime and violence in our cities, the border crisis, a new chapter for an iconic game show, and the relentless stress of COVID-19, masks, mandates, and madness. Stand by as we're about to embark upon a bold hour of Black Belt Talk Radio, in which your tolerance for hearing different but legitimate points of view will be tested. We've got lefties, righties, and thoughtful independents waiting in the wings to tickle your brain with notions and emotions. Try not to get angry, just skeptical. We'll hear from Paul Vandenberg in Albany, New York, Tom Hartman in Portland, Oregon, Dr. Dahlia Wax in Las Vegas, Nevada, Steve Wiseman in Boston, Massachusetts, and Victoria Jones in Washington, D.C. Opinionated yappers from across the country with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices sharing their observations as well as the feelings of their target constituents with whom they do their daily dance of affirmation in a deafeningly noisy world in which we try to avoid the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Wrap, heard coast to coast and around the world on great radio stations in the U.S. and the U.K., a hyper-verbal examination of the past week's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media and played out in the theater of your mind. Information's gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. Fasten your earbuds. Okay, here we go. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about stories on talk shows in America this past week.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10, Jeopardy chooses new hosts. After several months of on-air tryouts and a variety of celebrity hosts, ranging from Katie Couric to LeVar Burton, the producers of Jeopardy have finally named their full-time replacements for the late Alex Trebek. Actually, they named two replacements, the show's executive producer Mike Richards and actress Mayim Bialik.
Many media observers see Jeopardy as the symbol of old-school over-the-air television and one of the few national pastimes that brings Americans, especially families, together.
At number 9, the California recall tied with local and regional politics. The California special election to recall Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom is really starting to heat up, with nationally syndicated conservative radio talk host Larry Elder leading the GOP pack in the early polls.
All across the country, from Los Angeles to the Big Apple, local talk show hosts are discussing forthcoming city and state elections and issues, proving the importance of local talk radio as a bellwether of public opinion and a mainstay of American democracy.
At number 8, the southern border crisis tied with immigration reform. Speaking of talk radio, although the mainstream media seems to have swept the humanitarian crisis at the southern border under the carpet, it remains a burning issue on radio talk shows.
And rightly so. The Biden administration, even though it has a heck of a full plate, would be wise to address this problem more aggressively.
At number 7 this week, U.S.-China relations tied with Afghanistan turmoil. Although American foreign policy continues to be focused on growing tensions with China, the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan has taken center stage as we pull out of an extremely unpopular war.
There's been a hefty price to pay as 3,000 troops have had to be redeployed to that suffering nation to protect the evacuation of American personnel and citizens living there as the Taliban swoops in, taking over city after city, overcoming the weak resistance of local Afghan forces now going it alone.
At number 6, the heat wave, wildfires, and climate change. A blaze known as the Dixie Fire continues to ravage forests, towns, and villages in Northern California, as the heat wave and drought continues.
That fire is now burning 780 square miles and is reportedly less than one-third contained. In Montana, several thousand people remain under evacuation orders in the state's southeast, where a blaze called the Richard Spring Fire is threatening dozens of small communities, including the Northern Cheyenne Indian Reservation. Large fires are currently burning in 14 states, mostly in the west.
At number five, a four-way tie between voting legislation, race relations, police reform, and crime and violence. Voting legislation remains a huge issue both nationally and locally and is one of the driving forces in the ongoing discussion of race relations in America.
Meantime, the spike in urban crime and homelessness is the political topic in the nation's big cities. And that, of course, ties into the controversial and often misunderstood issue of police reform. I say misunderstood because there's a difference between police reform and police defunding.
At number four this week, a three-way tie between social media censorship, defamation lawsuits, and cybercrime. The Dominion Election System's defamation lawsuit against individuals and TV networks has the nation buzzing over complex issues of free speech in the world of journalism and the murky world of partisan infotainment.
A judge threw out an appeal by Sidney Powell, Mike Lindell, and Rudy Giuliani, all the targets of a billion-dollar-plus defamation lawsuit by Dominion.
At number three, the Cuomo resignation and the Me Too movement. The rise and fall of one of America's most prominent politicians has been compelling news.
It includes an array of issues, including the potentially criminal nursing home deaths cover-up and the scandalous sexual harassment charges of some 11 women.
At number two, the economy, infrastructure bill, and inflation fears. In a rare showing of bipartisan cooperation, the Senate approved a $1 trillion infrastructure bill.
The historic legislation will rebuild the nation's deteriorating roads and bridges and fund new climate resilience and broadband initiatives.
And at number one this week, COVID-19 vaccines, masks, and mandates. The Delta variant has dealt a severe blow to America's recovery from the pandemic, and there could be even more dangerous strains of the coronavirus waiting in the wings.
And so we're back at the political bickering over masks and mandates, with the focus this week being centered on public school safety as the summer of 21 enters its final weeks. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. One of the hottest topics of conversation on talk shows across America this past week has been the resignation of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo as a result of alleged inappropriate behavior as a serial perpetrator of sexual harassment in the workplace, not to mention misdeeds in office pertaining to the cover-up of nursing home COVID-19 numbers. Joining us to discuss this situation is our man in Albany, Paul Vandenberg, radio station owner and talk show host at our affiliate in the Empire State Capital City, WGDJ, Talk 1300. So who is Kathy Hochul? What should we know about her?
Kathy Hochul, the lieutenant governor, now steps up, and actually after 14 days, Cuomo gave himself 14 days to leave. So she will step in after 14 days after his announcement this past Tuesday, and she'll be governor. She's from Western New York, former county clerk. She spent one term in Washington working elected to the House of Representatives, and she's been a lieutenant governor here for 6 years. She has had virtually no relationship with Andrew Cuomo, according to people at the Capitol, and according to her the other day when she gave her initial press conference on Wednesday, when she announced that everybody here knows I haven't had a great relationship with the governor. She's been distant from him. Not because of the issues, though. She's been distant from him because the Cuomo people, Andrew, and the people directly around him are really distant from everybody. And she has had virtually no relationship with him. She described herself as a ribbon cutter, which is what she's been. But she's doing a little bit of that also because she doesn't want to be associated with him. She will be the governor for a year. Next year, there will be an election in New York State to replace Andrew Cuomo. Kathy Hochul will have a year to try to set herself up so that she could possibly win a primary next year and go on and run for governor. But that, too, will be a tall order. It's going to be a tall order for her, Mike, from the minute she steps in.
I bet it is. Interesting that it is a distant woman replacing him. It's kind of convenient in a way, in terms of at least there's some type of a fresh start.
There is. Well, let me tell you, it'll be a totally fresh start when she announces a lieutenant gubernatorial mate and when she changes the stat, because everybody will go. The people closest to him have all got to go. They've all been turning their head and holding their nose while Andrew Cuomo, you know, I'll give you one example for people across the country. The health department, COVID numbers, the deaths in the nursing home that you've all heard about. Well, Andrew and his staff were going in and altering those numbers. This is one of the initial reports that the attorney general went after Andrew about. They've been doing things like that. None of these people can be trusted. And they're all going to have to go. Hochul is going to have a whole new group of people with her. And to get back to your original question, you're 100% right, Mike. It's going to be a fresh start.
What's the feeling and the mood in Albany?
You know, Mike, it's one word. It's relief. Everybody's thrilled to see him go.
Wow.
Whether you're in government or out of government, this guy has been, he's a bully. And people have sat here and watched him bully people for the last 11 plus years. Everybody's sick of this guy. And remember, I'll tell you another thing. I'll tell you a couple other things, too. Number one, he grew up around here. Okay. When his dad was governor, he didn't grow up here. He went to school in the city, but he was around here all the time. And everybody knew about him. He's a bully. He's a pain in the backside. And he was all that while he was governor. But I'll also tell you this about Cuomo. And I bring it up to the guests I have on the radio. Every one of them, I ask them this question. Because Andrew Cuomo is 63 years old, mic'd to a man and woman. Every person I've asked, did you see this coming? Was there any whispers about Andrew and women before? Everyone says no. Nobody ever had an issue with him with women in the past. In fact, if you remember, when he divorced his first wife, Carrie Cuomo, she was the one that was having an affair. It was splattered all over the front page of the New York Post. Mm. She was involved with some tennis pro or something. There was nothing in Andrew Cuomo's background to indicate that he would get friendly or put his hands where they didn't belong. Not once in his life. It's amazing.
Mm. Interestingly, he also politically used the Me Too movement as one of his crusades. He not only didn't have that reputation, but he used it as one of his flags. You know, I'm a champion of women's causes. So what do you attribute that to? Do you think that these are blown out of proportion, or do you think it's just one of those things that people didn't notice or talk about?
Well, no, you find a lot of people in the Democratic Party attach themselves to these movements. It's been a spot in the Democratic Party where, you know, they all seem to be involved. A lot of Republicans too, but it started with the Democrats where, you know, they get involved in the Me Too type movements, the pro women movements, and they embrace them. And they, you know, they encourage them. And publicly, Mike, it's like so many other things. Publicly, they do one thing. Human beings do one thing. And behind the scenes, they do something else. It's just, he got caught doing it. That's all.
Well, you know, it wasn't that long ago. Elliot Spitzer, well, I mean, it was a long time ago, but... to me, it doesn't seem that long ago that he too, you know, Me Too, only with prostitutes. But he was shown as a hypocrite. If you recall, as a DA and as a governor, he was cracking down on prostitution, and then he gets caught with one. It is amazing how hypocritical politicians can be, and there's a lesson in it. I also find amazing, and I'm sure you'll agree, how you could be riding high. How's that song go? That's life, Frank Sinatra. You could be riding high in May and shot down in September. I mean, it wasn't that long ago. Right. Andrew Cuomo was the hero of the Democratic Party. And now, of course, they're all distancing themselves from him. Fortunes turn very quickly nowadays, don't they?
They sure do. In fact, just to follow up on our last conversation, about the women's movement. You know, you look this week at Roberta Kaplan. She's with the Time's Up group, and she was advising Cuomo. You know, Time's Up is for a group for women that help women when they're abused by men. And she was advising him how to get after the women that were accusing him. So she wound up leaving or resigning, I should say, from Time's Up. Yeah, the Spitzer thing, the Spitzer thing was just like the Spitzer thing. In fact, Mike, here in Albany, that was a big topic of conversation, the idea that you were as surprised on Tuesday when Cuomo stepped aside as you were when Spitzer did. When Spitzer did, I was about to go on the air. I got a phone call from Fred Dicker at the New York Post. He said to me, you know, they just arrested Spitzer. Are Spitzer's going to have to step down now for being with a prostitute? this with Cuomo was as shocking as all that because of what, as you point out, 18 months ago. 18 months ago, Cuomo was the king of the world, Emmy Awards. People wanted to marry him. You had the, as the New York Post also was pointing out the other day, you had the Cuomo-sexuals, they called them, these women that love Cuomo. He was a hero. And now here he is 18 months later, and it's just, it's a disgraceful ending is what it is.
That's Paul Vandenberg, a talk show host and the station owner of our affiliate in Albany, New York, Talk 1300. Coming up next, an intensive look at the impact of COVID-19. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. One of the great bands of the golden age of album rock, Gun Hill Road, has been around for more than 50 years. The members of Gun Hill Road are Steve Goldrich, Paul Reich, Glenn Leopold, Brian Coonan, and yours truly, Michael Harrison. I wrote the lyrics to a song on our new album, What Year Is This? It's titled, I Know You're Real. It's about the relationship between human beings and our friends in the animal kingdom.
I know you're real.
Please take a moment to write down the following web address to see the music video of this inspirational song that contains some wonderful animal images that'll rock your heart and soothe your soul. Here's the address. Write it down. IKnowYouAreReal.com. That's IKnowYouAreReal.com. If you love animals, you'll feel real good after seeing this video. IKnowYouAreReal.com. Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap. The spread of the COVID-19 Delta variant has proven to be a setback in our nation's recovery from the pandemic. Now we're back to arguing about masks, mandates, and the efficacy of vaccines. Let's head out now to Portland, Oregon, home of syndicated radio talk show host Tom Hartman, one of America's leading progressive radio voices. Tom, our friends Phil Valentine in Nashville and Mark Bernier in Daytona Beach, Florida, are in the hospital fighting for their lives. And Dick Farrell, also in Florida, has lost his life. As a progressive, what are your thoughts about these conservatives' misfortune?
I'm so saddened by this, Michael. I have not discussed this on the air on my program because I'm not a big fan of Schadenfreude. I think that what this tells me is that these are folks who actually believe what they're saying. And that being the case, I honor them, actually. If you believe what you're saying enough to put yourself in front of a speeding train or a deadly virus, my hat goes off to you. You look at the 50%, roughly, of the Republican members of the U.S. House of Representatives who refuse to disclose whether they're vaccinated or not. And I'm not the only one, but I have it from pretty good authority on the inside that all of them are vaccinated, but they just don't want to tell the rubes, you know. They realize that they're running a scam. They're just trying to crash the economy so they can blame it on Joe Biden going into the 2022 election. You know, the more people who get sick, the more likely the economy is to crash. It's what happened to Trump. It's why he's not president right now. And but when talk show hosts who are walking their talk end up getting caught by it, it fills me with a deep sadness, but also a certain amount of respect.
I really am glad to hear you say that you're not a fan of they're getting what they deserve. You know that there's so much of that going on. There's so much of that going on right now.
That's poison. It's just poison, Michael.
Yeah. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, you go through this all the time. People say, oh, you know so-and-so, you know so-and-so. I hate that person. What a terrible person. And you know, as well as I know, that sometimes a person's character and whether they're just a nice person or an honest person or whatever has nothing to do with their political position on the air. There are people on the air whose politics I completely agree with, and I try not to go public with too much politics because I try in my job to remain as impartial as possible from a partisan standpoint. But, I know people and I have my own feelings, and some of the worst on-air scoundrels, if you will, on all sides, are some of the nicest people, and some people who people, oh, I love this guy. I think that, you know, and they're terrible people. It's right. There's such yeah. a there's
the
such
Charlie
a
Charlie Roses and Matt Lauers of the world.
Yeah,
yeah, it really is a weird dynamic, and you don't really understand it until you get inside the business. Mm-hmm.
But you know, look, I have been on record as being pro-vaccination. I know you have, and I mean, when you really push him, even Donald Trump has said that. Although you know, he talks out of both sides of his mouth on that particular topic.
Well, he got vaccinated secretly.
Right, exactly. I mean, which is
like the Republicans in Congress, a hypocrisy.
Now he's got to certainly you know, realize that sends a signal. But when you get somebody like Phil Valentine, who he's not quite an anti-vaxxer. He could be interpreted as such because, you know, do as I do, not as I say, or whatever. He openly said he's not getting the vaccine. His reasons were that he was in good health and that he had very, you know, low odds of getting it. And here he is at the time that we're doing this recording this conversation. He's still, you know, in very, very critical condition. And the future.
Oh, his lungs are ravaged.
Yeah. So
what I'm reading.
Yeah. So, but he has stated, and his brother and family has stated, that if he had to do it again, or if he does get to do it again, he will be vehemently pro getting vaccination. That you know, I think it takes a very big man, even if it takes something as dramatic as this. It takes a very big person to admit when they're wrong. We don't have enough of that. Or not even necessarily, I'm not saying right or wrong. What I'm saying is to, if he believes he's wrong, to turn around and say, I was wrong. Right. We don't have enough of that.
Yeah.
And a lot of people and a lot of sides, a lot of extremes are going to have to start doing that if we're ever going to work our way out of this crazy jungle that we're in.
I absolutely agree. And I think that, you know, to shift to the infrastructure bills, that's this come to Jesus moment that's happening within the Democratic Party right now too, is, you know, are we going to hold the positions that we've held publicly and fight to the death for them, or are we going to compromise?
Well, do you think that we're ever going to learn how to compromise again? Because that's the magic word, compromise. When you perceive everything about the other party to be the enemy, and or even if you agree with them, because we see that all the time. We see both sides blaming the others for being wrong when it's the same thing that side was for at a different time. It's shocking. Do you think that maybe this infrastructure bill will be looked upon as a light at the end of this tunnel, and that we could start to enjoy compromise where the Republicans and the Democrats gain by doing something that benefits the whole country?
Yeah, and I think the $1 trillion bill, by and large, does that. You know, it's going to have a net positive impact on the country and hopefully on the planet. Most of the climate change stuff was stripped out of it in order to satisfy the Republican requirements and has been moved into the $3.5 trillion bill. And as someone who's concerned about climate change being something that could destroy our civilization, I'm a partisan for both of these pieces of legislation. And now we've got this real delicate dance going on because you've got the corporate Democrats like, you know, Joe Manchin saying, well, I'm not a big fan of the $3.5 trillion bill. I think it's too much. It's too big. And then you've got the progressive Democrats in the House, the whole progressive caucus, saying, we're not going to vote for your $1 trillion. You know, it's only $500 billion in new spending over 10 years. I mean, it's $50 billion a year. It's like not even a drop in the bucket. We're not going to vote for that unless we get a concurrent vote for our $3 trillion over 10-year bill. And if they hold firm to that, then everybody's going to get what they want. You know, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema will get their $1 trillion bill passed, and they'll be able to say, see, we could work with Republicans, and the Republicans will be out there taking credit for everything, just like they did with the American Rescue Act. Not a single Republican voted for it, but over 40 Republican members of Congress have done major campaign ads based on it, you know. Mm-hmm. So they'll be out there taking credit for it. And then the progressives too, you know, they'll get their bigger package and they'll be able to say, see, we held the line and we got this done. I am so hopeful. And this is, by the way, what President Biden has come right out and said, he hopes is the outcome. So I'm cautiously optimistic, Michael.
You're about to publish yet another book in your Hidden History series, The Hidden History of Healthcare. Give us a sneak preview, Tom.
Well, a couple of points. Number one, because we have a for-profit health insurance system, which no other developed country in the world has, the average American family pays $3,000 a year more for health care than a comparable family using the same level of health care would in Canada, and about $4,000 a year more than the most people in most European countries pay, number one. Number two, the obscene profits that are generated by this have a real distorting influence or impact on who we serve and how we serve them and what kinds of medicine are available to us and when and where and all these things. And that, you know, is something that needs to be addressed. And then number three, interestingly, I think the reason why this, one other thing I want to point out really quickly is, in the United States, pre-COVID, we were averaging 500,000 to 600,000 medical bankruptcies a year. That's a 500,000 families who are just destroyed because somebody got sick in their family. The total number of medical bankruptcies in Canada, Germany, France, all of Scandinavia, the United Kingdom, you combine all those countries and a half a dozen other European countries together every year. The total is zero. Here in the United States, 600,000. And last year it was 800,000 because of COVID. And this year they're guessing it's going to be over 1 million families who are going to declare bankruptcy. So I think the pressure is building to stop shoveling profits to companies like United Healthcare, whose CEO, Dollar Bill McGuire, took $1.6 billion in compensation. He was followed by Stephen Hemsley, who took $900 million in compensation. You know, pretty much every penny of that, the result of somebody saying, no, your kid can't have a liver transplant. To a system that actually cares for people rather than billionaires and big insurance companies.
That syndicated radio talk show host and Talkers Heavy 100 member, Tom Hartman. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Speaking of COVID-19, my guest this week for the Michael Harrison Interview podcast is Genesis Communications Network talk show host Dr. Dahlia Wax. Here's a timely excerpt from that podcast.
The Delta variant has proven to be quite a problem. And as of this moment, I have noticed in the inside pages of the newspaper, not the headline, that there's another variant out there that has doctors worried. Is it the Lambda variant? I'm not sure what the name is, but what's going on out there? Who's the next game after Cincinnati, as a football reference that I think you
exactly
might know.
Exactly. So the Lambda variant comes from South America. I think it was first isolated in Chile. And so, you know, people have trouble remembering all these variants. I remember Lambda from like Lima, Peru. I remember Gamma from the Rio Games. That's how I remember Brazil. Gamma, Delta from New Delhi, India. So, I mean, there's ways to kind of remember these, but Lambda comes from South America, and it has already made its way to America as, you know, people are traveling, people are coming into the country. There was no surprise. And Lambda variant seems to be one that also can be wily and outsmart our vaccines. One study has shown that the Delta variant and Lambda variant are kept at bay by the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, even more so than Johnson & Johnson. But nothing is going to be absolute. It can sadly mutate as well to become stronger. So we're definitely watching this one, as well as Dr. Fauci has warned that with this huge wave of Delta variants, more variants can be made in different cities. So he wants us to be prepared, you know, for a rough winter. And which is why I'm recommending everybody still get the flu shot, because the last thing we need is flu. We are seeing some flu cases in Australia right now, so we will have some flu this next season, but the best way to protect yourself against any of these variants is getting a flu vaccine, but also getting your COVID vaccine.
I want to back up a little bit to a line of questioning I had before, and I think we went off track. I just want to get your opinion. Do you think that we have gotten lax in our zeal to get past masks and past shutdowns and past this thing and go back to normal, a word that is a ridiculous word in these times, normal? Have we become too engaged in wish thinking, and that we're really still in a serious problem?
Well, it's interesting. We are in a serious problem. This pandemic is serious, but I think what people are frustrated about is they did the masks, they did the lockdowns, they did the vaccinations, and everybody still got hit with Delta. So when vaccinated individuals are telling me, are you kidding me? I'm sick again. When I think you have people starting to realize that our mask protocol isn't good enough. And maybe our vaccine protocol isn't good enough. And this is where we talked about in terms of the frame of reference. Why did we pitch that this was going to be 100%? If we told people that your face coverings are still going to, you know, get virus behind them, and that vaccinated individuals could still spread it, then maybe we wouldn't have had such high expectations. But because we were pitched that if you do this and you close down your bakery and you close down your store and if you stay in and don't go to the movie theater, it's all going to be over. It, when people saw that didn't happen, now it's like the boy who cried wolf. So I don't know if we got too lax. I understand Sturgis is going to be a very highly, you know, anticipated and watched after, you know, super spreader event. People were ripping on President Obama and his 60th birthday party. I'm like, look at the Olympics. The Tokyo Olympics pushed through. They knew those athletes worked their butts off. They had about 430 cases, but I don't think anybody was hospitalized. I don't think anybody died. And the Tokyo Olympics was still able to happen. The 2020 election was still able to happen. So if we're going to decide collectively that we're going to let the Olympics happen, we're going to allow an election to happen during a pandemic, that we're going to have to be okay with there being cases and let marriages happen. Let, you know, proms happen. Let school graduations happen.
That's radio physician Dr. Dahlia Wax of the Genesis Communications Network. The conversation you just heard was a small part of an in-depth discussion I had with Dr. Wax about the pandemic on the latest installment of my podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview. You can hear it at mhinterview.com. Coming up next, we'll discuss the anti-defamation lawsuits being filed by Dominion Voting Systems against people such as pillow guy Mike Lindell, attorney Sidney Powell, and former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, along with TV networks Fox News Channel, One American News, and Newsmax TV for more than $1 billion, as well as news about another ransomware attack on a big company, a multi-million dollar cyber hack of cryptocurrency, and the powers that be at Jeopardy finally announcing their hosting plans. We'll be joined by one of the nation's leading cybercrime fighters, Steve Wiseman of Scamicide.com, and our international woman in the nation's capital, Victoria Jones of the DC Radio Company. Heck of a show. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap.
Some mistakes you just can't fix, like your retirement. You only get one chance, and with Grace Advisors, we'll help you make the most out of your one chance at a great retirement. At Grace Advisors, we make sure your retirement income is not at risk with the up and down ride of the stock market roller coaster. Instead, we build a foundation for your retirement, where, when the market's up, you're up. When the market's down, you lose nothing, and we structure your plan in a way that you will save more on taxes, giving you an even greater return on your nest egg. So speak with the Grace Advisor, a Christian company, helping families protect their future every day. Call 888-585-1615. That's 888-585-1615. Call 888-585-1615 and speak to a Grace Advisor today. Or visit graceadvisors.com/radio.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap as we discuss the hottest topics of the past week in the national conversation. There's been lots of talk this week about Dominion Election Systems suing people like Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, and Mike Lindell, and platforms such as OAN, Newsmax, and Fox News Channel for defamation, not to mention an array of cyber criminal stories. When things of this nature pop up, we turn to our expert on such matters, Bentley University and Boston law professor and founder of Scamicide.com, Steve Wiseman. Where would you like to start?
You know, with the lawsuits with Dominion, because it's a story that's going to be here for a while, but just this week, a number of the defendants, including Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, and Mike Lindell of MyPillow, all filed motions to have the cases dismissed. And the judge did not allow those motions. And in fact, in the judge's opinion, he seemed to pretty strongly back these cases. And these cases are quite monumental and unusual when it comes to defamation law.
And how were they monumental in terms of breakthroughs or milestones? Are they setting precedent of any kind? Or just what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think they very well may, because, you know, we have had laws that protect the media, and to a great extent, these are comments that have been made in the media and by media, particularly the comments of Fox News, which was one of the defendants. There has been protection for many, many years since the seminal case of New York Times versus Sullivan, and in that case, the Supreme Court unanimously decided that when it comes to defamation, the media should receive some extra protection, and that they may make mistakes, but it's really important for the public to be informed. And so, in order to win a case against the media, you have to prove that the statement was made either deliberately as a lie, they call that with malice, or with a reckless disregard for the truth. And this is a very, very high standard to meet, and that's one reason why you don't generally see lawsuits successful against the media. But that seems to be in real danger in this case, and we're talking significant amounts of money that could be owed by these defendants.
This really is right along that fine line, especially for people like us who believe so strongly in the First Amendment, but also believe in not doing damage and harm. It really is a fine line between really doing damage and irresponsibility versus free speech, the First Amendment, being able to reveal news. And this whole election fraud thing has been such a heated debate now for so long. It really even makes this more explosive. This is a tough one, isn't it?
It is, but it shouldn't be. And, you know, this is one of the things, is reading through the 438-page complaint, I was struck by the fact that I don't think the First Amendment is in as much danger here as many of our colleagues would believe. And the reason is, as they start looking at the facts, there is a responsibility with being on the air. And it is, you just don't make wild statements figuring you're going to be okay with it, that you can say anything. You know, our words, they have repercussions. So I'll give you a couple of examples. One of the things cited in the complaint was by One America News, where they had Edward Solomon, a mathematician, with evidence of algorithms rigging the election. Wow! That is pretty, pretty significant, except for the fact that Edward Solomon is not a mathematician. Edward Solomon has no degree in anything. Edward Solomon is an installer for a swing set company who's a convicted felon for drug dealing. So someone having him on, you accept him. And this is the big argument here, that these individuals and networks amplified and endorsed obvious falsehoods. And when we say obvious falsehoods, it's one of the things you notice a lot when, particularly in the allegations with Fox News. Fox News has a political bend to it, but Fox News generally reports facts. There may be a bend to it, but they report facts. Mm-hmm. And you would, when the allegations have been against Fox, they have been more against the commentators who have been saying they've been buying into and pushing the lies. And there is a responsibility. You know, we actually are seeing a response where Newsmax, which is, you know, another conservative outlet, actually had an anchor walk out on a live interview with Lindell, the guy, Mike Lindell from MyPillow, when Lindell started making obvious false statements.
You know the old saying, you can't get blood from a stone? You know, you hear about these lawsuits in the billions now with Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani and Mike Lindell. What happens in the law if they were found, you know, if those suits were held up? These people don't have that kind of money. What would happen in terms of the debt?
Yeah, it wouldn't get, you're right, it wouldn't get paid. When you're going against Sidney Powell, when you're going against Rudy Giuliani, you're going to, you may bankrupt them, but that's it. You're not going to get money, you're making this statement. You know, you mentioned Giuliani, and there have recently been, just in the past couple of weeks, a number of lawyers who have been sanctioned in court and ordered to pay money, including the defense funds, for allegations that they stated as fact in court that were out and out lies, and in regard to the rigging of the election. And Giuliani, and people may have many different opinions about Giuliani, but he's an intelligent man. He's an intelligent lawyer. He knows a lawyer. He has made all kinds of false allegations about Dominion on the air, on his show, and being interviewed. He has never made one of those statements in court. And it sort of shows that he knows they're not correct. He thinks he can get away with it on the air, but he knows not to say it in court. But getting back to your answer, I think this is public relations for Dominion. And it's not just public relations. They're losing money. They, you know, this is a company that is losing clients and states that otherwise would use their technology, but now may feel that they're tampered with.
Okay, switching gears now to the ransomware story against Accenture, a big IT company. What's the story there? Is ransomware something we still have to worry about?
It is not still a problem. It is going to continue to be a problem, and it's only getting worse. If you want to look at the glass as totally not empty, you can say that President Biden just recently enacted some new regulations to bring the public sector and the private sector to work together. And in fact, this new infrastructure bill, if it does become law, will have some efforts in there and funds in there for actions against ransomware.
And in terms of the crypto hacking, are people who invest in cryptocurrency such as Bitcoin in danger of losing their fortunes or losing their investments because of hacking?
To some extent, but you know, looking at the recent $600 million hacking, and of that, about $258 million has been returned. But the bottom line with that is a lot. You can go back to Shakespeare. The fault is not in the stars; the fault is in us. More often than not, it is not the cryptocurrency companies themselves, but it is individual people who have their crypto wallets and don't sufficiently secure them. So I'm still wary on a lot of levels of cryptocurrencies, and I don't think they're good for people who don't totally understand them. But as far as the vulnerability of the major cryptocurrency platforms, they're pretty good.
That's our legal correspondent, Bentley University and Boston law professor, and founder of the incredible website Scamaside.com, Steve Wiseman. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Okay, we have time for one more. Let's head to the nation's capital and check in with our Washington correspondent and pop culture perceptionist, executive director of the D.C. radio company, Victoria Jones. Jeopardy was on the top 10 survey of things being talked about. I guess Jeopardy is one of America's great national pastimes. And certainly the last few months, as the producers of the show tried to find a replacement for the late Alex Trebek, they came up with Mike Richards, the executive producer of the show, and Miam Bialik, the actress that everybody seems to love. I have to confess to you, and I say confess because, you know, I'm always so busy, I don't have time for things. I watched every episode and every guest host since they began this process. What do you think of them apples?
I think that's fascinating. And I first started watching Jeopardy when I first arrived in the United States, and I just became hooked on the show, and I discovered that you could do other things and watch Jeopardy, because you hear the what is, and you're doing something, and you shout out the answer.
If I were a contestant on the show, I would be blown out every time because I always forget to do it as a question. I just throw out the answer. Could you imagine the pressure of being a contestant on that show?
I can't imagine the pressure because it is enormous, and you feel like you're representing everybody. Everybody, not just yourself, not just your family and your town and your state, but somehow you are everybody on that show.
Well, certainly, and everybody you know.
Everybody you know. And, you know, for me, if I were a contestant on that show, I think my scariest moment would be, what are going to be the categories? Because there are some categories I know I can do, I think. And then some categories, they would come up and it would be, oh, no.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the brilliance, the genius of how they created that show. I mean, I think Merv Griffin was the original guy who put this thing together. And it is extraordinarily well-balanced and well-designed. My biggest fear, if I were to be on it, is the same fear that I had about being a contestant, not that they offered me the job, on who Wants to Be a Millionaire, that I would blow it in the easy questions. That to me would be humiliating. My fear for Jeopardy would be not to make it into Final Jeopardy, to be the one that you are in the red, you cannot play the left. That has got to be, oh my God, the rest of my life, I was publicly disgraced by not making it to Final Jeopardy. That you could see it, the people's faces. It's like they were hit over the head with a baseball bat. But I watched very carefully this whole thing out of, first of all, I do like the show. I find it to be personally challenging all the time. But I found it to be a very interesting media examination, how a game show of that gigantitude goes through a process like this. And just as it's not easy to be a contestant on that show, it's extraordinarily difficult within the world of game shows. Not that I've ever been a game show host, but it's a form of hosting. It's a form of media. It's fascinating to watch. And it's definitely a skill that takes a tremendous amount of learning and practice to see how these people handle themselves at dealing with one of the hardest jobs in television, and that is to be the host of Jeopardy, because it's fast. You've got to be on your feet. You've got to keep it going. You've got to be able to do mathematical computations in your head. And all the time you do it, you can't appear to be wanting to upstage the show or the contestants themselves. That is a real daunting task, if you ask me. And my predictions before they – listen to me boasting about my prognostications over Jeopardy. My predictions were that the two contenders would be Mike Richards and Mayim Bialik. And it turned out that he got the job, and she's going to be the sort of the backup, and she's going to do specials. So, hey, I'm a happy camper. Did you have any picks or favorites?
I didn't have any picks. Well, actually, I did have a favorite, and that was LeVar Burton. But then that's because I'm a Trekkie, and I couldn't help it. But I always felt that it would not be like a major, major, major celebrity, because as you've already said, it's not about the celebrity, it's about the people who are doing the show. But I also felt that what is an irreplaceable host?
That's our Washington correspondent and pop culture perceptionist, Victoria Jones of the DC Radio Company. This has been the Michael Harrison Wrap, looking back at the past week of Monday, August 9th through Friday, August 13th, 2021. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times. I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. And that does it for this week's installment of The Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications in conjunction with Talkers Magazine and Talk Media Network. Copyright 2021, all rights reserved.